Hey everyone, this is Judy Warner with Altium's On Track podcast. Thanks for joining us again. I appreciate everyone that's following. We are spreading like wildfire, and we thank you for all your comments and opinions, and we always look forward to hearing about things you want to hear from. So reach out to us. On Twitter, I'm at AltiumJudy, or you can connect with me on LinkedIn, or Altium is on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter. So today I have a longtime friend and ex-colleague, Jay Colonnery, and Jay is the Director of Business Development at EIT, which is Electronic Instrumentation and Technology in Richmond, Virginia. And you're going to have fun just listening to Jay, because it's like talking to Matthew McConaughey. No. So for you girls out there, we're going to just have fun listening to Jay talk. Just kidding. But he does have a nice southern drawl. So Jay, thanks so much for joining us today. And we look forward to talking to you about DFA and some technical stuff today. So thanks for joining.
Thank you for having me. This is an exciting time at EIT. We just added an Altium capability, and so I'm delighted to get the word out. And what better way to do it than talking to you?
Well, you know, when you suck up to your friends at Altium, you get on a podcast. That's how it works around here.
Great.
So, Jay, why don't you start out by telling our listeners a little bit about your educational background and your professional background, set the stage for us.
Okay, sure. I picked up a double E degree at Virginia Tech and then a master's in double E at the University of Virginia. So you could say I'm a son of Virginia for sure. I managed to spend most of my career here in the Mid-Atlantic. And my career spans from board level electronic design to integrated circuits, VLSI design, and then kind of jumped over to the other side of the table and became an applications engineer doing custom microelectronics, and had a few years running a rep firm, making some commissions along the way, and then ended up in the printed circuit board business, working for DDI and Via Systems, now TTM. And one of my customers was a company called Zentech, which was an electronic manufacturing services company, and I went to work for them, and now I work for EIT, who is also situated in the Mid-Atlantic. I do want to correct one thing you mentioned. I live in Richmond, Virginia, but EIT is based in Leesburg, Virginia, with two other facilities. So we can talk some more about that.
All right. Thanks for correcting me there. So with all that variety of background, why don't you tell us a little bit about where you are now and about EIT and what their expertise is and what kind of technology mix they handle and so forth.
Yeah. Okay, so I joined EIT back in March. Very happy to be there. This is a company that's in its 42nd year of providing engineering services, which then led to electronic manufacturing services. So we do both. Engineering's very much in our DNA. We consider our engineering value add to be an important part of most of our customer relationships. So the thing about being in the electronic manufacturing service is that it's kind of a commodity when you look at it from the standpoint of just picking and placing parts with machines.
Right.
So we're looking to engage customers at additional levels, including engineering, turnkey builds, turnkey testing solutions of all manner, box build if necessary, demand fulfillment, soup to nuts, so that we're doing more than just using those machines. And EIT has three facilities along the East Coast. Altogether, we have over 200,000 square feet of brick and mortar, which makes us pretty big for a small company. We have a facility in Danville, Virginia, our headquarters in Leesburg, and then another in Salem, New Hampshire. Altogether, I've got 8 surface mount lines to keep busy. Danville is what we designate as our low-cost center of excellence. It's also a 100% vertically integrated location because it can do any kind of metal work, cabling, wire, box build. We have all that in place. It's a purpose-built facility to support the box builds, which we like to do for our customers. We don't do metal standalone, although occasionally I'll build a heat sink or something for somebody. Right. We tend to allocate that factory towards our customer box builds.
Okay.
And then Leesburg and Salem, New Hampshire are high-tech facilities. They both have this latest state-of-the-art universal equipment, so we can back each other up if something goes wrong. Mm-hmm. And they both have a full suite of the latest and greatest in automated inspection technologies and a full suite of test capability.
Wow, that sounds impressive.
It's a heck of a lot going on and a story that needs to get out. It's kind of been a secret lately.
Yeah, I haven't heard of them. I'm on the left coast, of course, but I had not heard of them. But they sound like a really great facility with a really good going all the way from true engineering to, mm-hmm. to box builds. That's nice. And we'll make sure to share the link, by the way, for any of you listeners who are looking for a good EMS or engineering service or whatever. We'll be sure to share that link on the show notes. So
yeah, thanks. And please do, because we're launching a new website next week. So I want to get
okay.
So hopefully the timing of that will work out.
Okay. All right. Good. We'll send you some traffic for your new website. So, Jay, because of the breadth of your knowledge and experience and background, I thought it'd be great for our listeners today if you shared a few tips from, you know, being that you came from some of the largest board manufacturers and certainly in North America and almost the world, maybe three tips or so on bare boards and then a few on DFA to help the designers in our audience and the engineers in our audience that might want to learn a few tips and tricks from a pro.
Okay. I came up with a few of each. Really when you're looking to design a printed circuit board, you have two fundamental objectives. One, to design it so that it can be fabricated reliably and with high yields. And then two, so that it can be assembled. So there's mistakes that can be made that can affect both key processes. So first of all, let's talk a little bit about PCB design issues that affect PCB fabrication and reliability. And, you know, none of these, I think, are going to be earth-shattering, but it's interesting to see the same mistakes being made a lot over and over again. So we just kind of keep, and we bang the drum and we hope everybody gets the message sooner or later. So I guess beginning with via and pad, there's more and more via and pad today, mm-hmm. By necessity. And via and pad, in order to be done reliably, requires a wrap plating process. Mm-hmm. Without getting into the specifics of what that does, the purpose of it is it provides a reliable button around the via. Uh-huh. Without the wrap plating process, it is an unreliable arrangement. But that requires the addition of more copper on the outer layers than you would see otherwise. And this wreaks havoc with the fine line design. So if you're at 3 mil tracing space or below, you really can't tolerate that extra copper. So it requires planning up front. Understand if you're going to need wrap plating, and if so, maybe move those fine line geometries to the inner layers where that won't come into play.
Okay. That makes sense.
So it'll get you. I mean, you'll think your design's done, and then the next thing you know, your fabricator says, well, you know, you realize I've got to add this much copper to the outside, and now you're violating tracing space.
I've seen this happen, too, when there's multiple on RF and microwave boards, too, when you have when you're doing sequential LAM or whatever, and you keep plating, and people don't. When they do their simulations, don't add in that those outer layers are getting extra copper too. So it really can throw you off.
Right.
All right. That's a good one.
Here's another one that, you know, I'm told they're still seeing a lot of it in the market by the guys that I used to work with at DDI. And that is they'll see overlapping via structures where the designer has put a via from say level 1 and 3 and another one from level 2 to 8 that can't be made. They have to be stacked. They have to be sequential. They can't be overlapping. But believe it or not, we see it. So
I've seen it many, many times.
Yeah.
But, you know, to be fair, sometimes when I look at those cords and figure out how they're going to be stacked up, I get confused too. So,
well, I mean, I'll say this again and again. Sit down with your PCB fabricator at the time you develop your stack up and your basic via structure. And your basic via structure is going to be driven by the toughest part of the design. Maybe it's a BGA with a finer pitch than you've ever used before.
Right.
You're not even sure how to route it. you're probably going to have to stack some micro VIAs, or at the very least have some blind or buried VIAs to get the job done. Sit down with the fabricator before you even start that router and make sure that everybody likes the stack up and that it looks manufacturable.
Yep. Yeah. Super, very sound advice. Yeah. Okay, that's another good one.
I've got one more I want to talk about, because this is happening more and more. You know, all the designs are getting faster and faster. I mean, high speed digital is now in the radio frequency, and FR4 just has too high a dielectric for most of the new designs now. So many PCB designers are going to have to work with materials they haven't worked with before. The more exotic, more expensive materials. And when you start talking about fabricating a PCB with Teflon versus FR4, you're talking about different processing altogether. So when you go to a new material, consult with your PCB guy as to which material would be suitable for the speed you're looking at, and ask them, okay, how have the rules changed with that material? What are your limitations? And you can ask your EMS provider the same question, because the printed circuit board is the foundation upon which all of our business is done. So we understand PCBs. But I think especially with materials, you want to talk to the fabricator.
Yeah, it's true. And when I work for an RF and microwave shop once, I told them, I said, you know, sometimes when you see a piece of Teflon material and a piece of, I don't know, Rogers 4350, until you strip the cover off, you can't tell it's different. But inside the board shop, that Teflon can turn into like bubble gum. It's not reinforced. But when you take the copper off and you go like this, it like flaps in the wind, where 4350 will remain rigid. So it kind of gives you a visual sense of this is radically different in the way that it processes inside the shop, and how the way it interacts with chemicals, moisture, heat. So it is true to the closer you can be when you go into those materials to your fabricator. Okay, those were three good ones. All right, good. How about DFA wisdom?
Okay, well, one we see it quite often, and I guess it's tempting for the designer to do this because he thinks he's kind of found a shortcut and a way to use less PCB area, but you see a lot of guys trying to use what we call common pads, and these are pads that are so close together that they touch, rather than routing a thin signal from pad to pad. So these pads do share the same signal, but we don't want them to physically share the same space. Oh. That causes us problems with controlling what the solder does once it flows. So so keep those pads apart and run a small signal trace between them, and then we'll let the solder mask do the rest, and we can control the flow of the solder. So that's a real simple one, but we run into it a lot.
Okay.
I talked before about via and pad. We see a lot of designs where people don't fill that via. If the via is in the pad, it's got to be filled, and it must be plated over and planarized. Sometimes that's done properly, sometimes it's not. There's a little dimple there.
Yep.
If there's a dimple in that pad, and I place a BGA ball on top of that, gas is going to get trapped underneath the solder paste that I apply, and there'll be a little air in that dimple. And heated gas expands. It expands ferociously. It doesn't want to stay where it is, and it'll blow all the solder right out of the pad at reflow time. I have customers argue with me against it. It is expensive to fill and planarize a via, but it's the right thing to do. You have to do it if you want reliable BGA connections. These are leadless parts that we can't inspect visually.
Right.
We have to use X-ray. Mm-hmm. It's not really practical to use 100% X-ray inspection, except on high reliability applications like military, maybe medical. Mm-hmm. So we lot sample these BGAs with the X-ray, and if we don't see any problems with the lot, then we carry on. So I can't emphasize that enough to fill those vias and fill those vias properly. And I would add further that there's no point. You know, we have some people that are using thermal vias. These are vias really who are designed not necessarily to conduct an electrical signal, although they do, but to conduct electricity from a hot part to maybe a ground plane, be an inner layer or wherever. You run into people who call out. So there has to be a filling to fill those vias before they're plated over.
Right.
And there's two types of filling. There's conductive and there's non-conductive. Mm-hmm. I strongly recommend never to use conductive. Non-conductive is much less expensive. The benefit of using conductive fill from a thermal point of view is super minimal. I mean, copper's doing all the work.
Okay.
And if you need to pull more current or more thermal energy, just create more thermal vias because the copper's doing all of the work. I'll give you some numbers. Thermal conductivity is defined in watt meters. A typical via is going to give you over 600 watt meters of conduction. If you fill it with conductive fill, you only get 6 more watt meters. What's that compared to 380? I'm sorry, 380 is what the copper gives you.
Okay.
The non-conductive only has 0.6 watt meters, but the point is both of those are in the noise compared to what the copper's doing.
Right.
And last but not least, good luck trying to get a printed circuit board fabricated in China with conductive fill. They don't do it over there.
Really?
Right. So, well, maybe somebody's doing it, but we're having a hard time finding them.
Interesting. So, yeah. Why is that?
Because it's not, it's
they
not
don't still like it. It's not important, so we're not doing it.
I don't think anybody should be doing it. Mm. It doesn't make sense to me. It's too expensive for the return.
Interesting. I'd never heard that before, actually. But it makes sense with those numbers. Yeah. I'm kind of surprised it took root for a while.
We recommended as far back as 5 years ago, DDI, not to use conductive fill. Huh. I think it's a dinosaur and its day has come and gone. But there's probably some engineers out there right now going, no!
Conductive.
We'll see.
Yeah, show me the data, you know, and when there's enough good research out there and data, people will stop doing it, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So, go ahead.
Breaking up a little bit. Can you hear me okay?
Sorry. Yeah, I can hear you fine.
Okay. So along the lines of thermal vias, here's another tip. A lot of times a thermal via will be located in a big plane. So you'll have the via and the copper button around it will actually be in contact with the plane. This is a no-no. This makes it very hard to deal with the solder flow again. So what we ask our customers to do is do a sprocket arrangement around that thermal via button.
Mm.
And so basically that button will exist. There'll be a gap between it and the plane around it. And then the sprockets are simply traces above, below, and to the right and left. So, and that it's an arrangement of a sprocket. Very good design practice, frequently missed. And it's not unusual that we have to go back and retool the board to add those in order to make especially back planes with active components. You see a lot of that, and they have to retool to add that feature to make it manufacturable.
Well, these are good tips. You were concerned you didn't have good tips. I think these are really good tips, actually.
Well, glad you do.
I do. Not that I spend all my days, you know, pondering DFA these days, but that's good. You know, Jay, you and I worked together for a small bit of time, and something I've noticed over the years, maybe 5-10 years, is seems like there's been a migration of where more EMS shops that I go into have PCB designers in their shop.
Mm-hmm.
And not so much, I guess, fabricators, at least that I've noticed. They may be there. Of course they do with larger shops. But why do you think that is, and why do you think that's a good idea?
Well, I think it's a great idea for both the customer and the EMS. We, as I mentioned before, we want to do more for the customer than just assemble his circuit cards. And if a customer, an Altium customer, finds himself in a position where they need to outsource some of their design, maybe their designers are saturated, maybe they just need the resources, what better place to do it than at a guy that knows how to assemble the cards and really understands the issues about fabrication and about assembly? Your chances are that the design from your EMS provider is going to go right through new product introduction without a hitch. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you do it internally and you're not aware of some of the issues, you know, it won't go through it without a hitch. We may not catch the problem until it's too late.
Yeah.
And you may see several tooling iterations and you'll see a delay. And nobody wants a delay during new product introductions. Everybody's in a hurry to get their prototypes. So,
and nobody wants to waste money because that's going to be expensive too.
Yeah, but we think there's a lot of serendipity between that particular engineering function and getting to what we all want, which is production of electronics.
Well, that does make sense in that we both know Mike Brown, and Mike I trusted implicitly to know about fab and assembly, and mm-hmm. he would catch all that stuff. So he did have a broader understanding than maybe somebody who just does, you know, has a consulting firm, say, that does designs, because he's around it all the time, all day long. So there's certainly a lot of exposure there. So that makes sense. Well, first of all, welcome to the Altium family. You told me recently that your designer onboarded Altium Designer 18. That's exciting mm-hmm. for us. So thank you for that. What made you, I'm gonna go for a little pat on the back for Altium right here, but I want you to tell us why EIT chose to go Altium Designer over perhaps another tool.
Okay, well, we think some of the key features of Altium, first of all, it's an all-inclusive package. So it's schematic capture and printed circuit board design. You don't have to worry about working with two different pieces of software.
Mm-hmm.
We like the fact that there's an ECAD-MCAD interface, which makes it really easy for us to do three-dimensional fit models
mm-hmm.
once we place the components. We love the room creation capability, which, as I understand it, allows you to take a previous design, a piece of it, and then just kind of cut and paste it right into your new design.
Yeah,
so you don't have to reinvent the wheel. I think that's pretty strong. And then last but not least, very solid DFM rules capability. Mm-hmm. that is really going to help us get to where we need to be. I mean, the fact is, these boards need to be designed to IPC standards, and the fabricators have tailored their process to meet these standards. And when you send them something that's outside those bounds, the mechanism sort of locks up. It just doesn't work. You'll get a no bid, or bells will go off. So those design rules are critical, and that you have the ability to set them up in advance is a nice piece of insurance. So, and I think it's a reasonably priced tool compared to the other high-end tools as well. So we're pleased to have it.
Good. Well, thank you again. We're happy to have you on board. And I'll needle you later about sending your designer to Altium Live, because we're going to have a really good conference with some good training coming up. So your designer will probably enjoy going if you guys have the time and budget to do that.
Well, keep me posted when and where.
I will. It's coming up in October. So, Jay, we're kind of wrapping up here, but if you've listened to these podcasts before, you'll know that sometimes I like to ask designers or engineers like yourself what you like to do after hours, and we call this portion of the podcast Designers After Hours. So I know you have a couple interesting hobbies, so why don't you tell those to our listeners? Because I think they're kind of fun.
Well, I'm looking forward to 10 days in Montana and Wyoming this September. I'm a big hiker, and nothing is more fun than hiking up in the beautiful Rocky Mountains. So we're gonna hit three national parks. We're going to do about 2 to 6 hours of hiking a day, or as much as my legs can give me, and just have an awesome lifetime outdoor experience, and hopefully not run into a grizzly bear along the way. my wife's really worried about that, by the way. So
bring your grizzly repellent.
And then I know you wanted me to talk about one other thing.
My favorite.
As you know, we business development types are very competitive, and Yeah, and what better setting to compete against each other than in a pub throwing some darts? So I've been a dart player since I was 19, and took it very seriously for a while, and spent way too much time on it. Actually, traveled every weekend to tournaments all around the United States, and played in a couple of U.S. Opens. But that was a long time ago. Now I just play for fun on Monday nights.
That cracks me up. You were the one and only competitive, traveling dart player that I know. Okay, but my favorite part is tell about the beer to success ratio of a good dart player.
So we're throwing a 27 gram projectile at a target about the size of a dime, and turns out that if you get nervous or you try too hard, you're not going to be very successful at that. So it turns out that second or third beer really kind of smooths out your stroke, and you generally shoot a little bit better. At least that's what we rationalize.
And what happens if you go over three?
Yeah, that's a slippery slope indeed. You've got to be careful.
That is so funny. Oh, my gosh. Okay, well, that was one of my favorite, I think, designer after-hour hobbies yet. So,
When I come out, we'll find a place and throw a few.
Okay. All right. I'll get my three beers ready.
Okay.
No, actually, for me, I'd be half a beer. Three beers, you'd be putting me in an Uber and sending me home. I'm a wimp. So, Jay, thanks so much for your time. These have been great tips, and it's good to see your face, my friend, and I wish you all the success at EIT, and we will certainly share all the links in the show notes, and we'll also put the link to Altium Live and in the show notes, and we'll encourage your designer to come out and join us as one of the new newbies to the Altium family, so we'll include that as well. So thanks again for joining, and we'll talk to you soon, my friend.
Thank you, Judy. It was my pleasure.
Thanks again for listening to the podcast. Again, this has been Judy Warner with the Altium On Track podcast and Jay Colonnery from EIT. And we look forward to seeing you next time. Until then, always stay on track.